Happy Halloween, and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, October 31st, and I'm Nat Cardos, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Dia de Muertos celebration at Eureka Theater November 2nd, Humboldt Soup spare cannabis farmer from permit revocation, and Ray Hamill with the sports report. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
On November 2nd, Centro de Pueblo will be hosting a Dia de Muertos celebration at the Eureka Theater. Centro's Dia de Muertos celebration started as a protest, bringing awareness not only to the celebration of the culture, but to the unjust treatment of immigrants in detention centers. Since then, it has evolved into a community celebration of tradition, culture, and persistence. KMUD News spoke with Brenda Perez, Executive Director of Centro del Pueblo, for more information on the event.
Yes, Dia de Muertos of Centro del Pueblo, or the Day of the Dead of CDP 2025, it's a cultural celebration full of tradition, mainly from Mexico, but also Central America, where we display altars, where we display music. We will have five different dance groups from Fortuna, Eureka, Arcata, and different schools also demonstrating their art in this special event for remembering our loved ones that have transitioned. We've been doing this for so long. We started it outside the courthouse as a protest, as a way to bring awareness of our loved ones that were dying in the detention centers and crossing the border from Mexico to the U.S. And from that point, more and more people got interested of our tradition. And we have seen in the last years how many other groups have adopted and shared also different events. So Centro del Pueblo started almost a decade now, and we are doing it every year.
Recently covered earlier this week, another Dia de Muertos event was canceled in Eureka due to safety concerns for the community due to ICE immigration raids, a concerning trend seen across California this season. Other Dia de Muertos events that have been canceled in other cities, like San Jose, Long Beach, and Victorville, to name a few in the state. Perez explains why continuing to have this event despite these fears is a statement.
Yes, for immigrants, for people that come from different countries, being able to celebrate our culture in the United States nowadays is a statement of we are here to stay, we are here to enjoy what the richness of our background is. For us, is having the memory of who we are before crossing the border and building a new life here at peace. Enriching the context, enriching the new community we are part of, despite of fear, despite of any type of tensions. We are doing this to root ourselves where we are and to showcase the beauty of our presence here.
Centro del Pueblo is a nonprofit organization that works for Latino and immigrant communities, regardless of immigration status, and supports members of the community of all ages. Other services they offer outside of hosting events include youth mental health services, cultural revitalization, and more.
Centro del Pueblo is a nonprofit organization that works for the empowerment of the immigrant communities, regardless of their immigration status. We provide support with mental health. For our youth, we are preventing youth suicide and youth abuse of substances. We are also working with women that are cultural bearers for becoming violence in the domestic aspect or just crossing the border. We are working with elders for cultural revitalization, and we are also working with little vendors for their economic relief. So we cover every aspect of the community right now, from youth to elders. And Dia de los Muertos is a space where they all come together. So you will have performers from 8 years old to 60 years old.
Organizing events like these can be a challenge, especially considering the current political climate. The event is largely funded from community donations, and performers and artists that participate get compensated for their time and being there, which can be a lot on the nonprofit organization.
People should know that organizing an event that is this size every year is a challenge, especially when there is rumors or threats against our communities, especially when there is a target over people like us, which are brown, which are portraying culture. And I want people to know that showing up for us is the greatest sign of solidarity. And I want them to be part. I want them to be part of this as a sign of protection as well.
The event will be at the Eureka Theater November 2nd from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. It's free and open to the public. And for more information, the website is cdpueblo.com. Humboldt County supervisors have revoked dozens of cannabis farming permits due to violations and non-payment of Measure S taxes, but gave reprieve to a farmer in Willow Creek. Daniel Mintz reports.
A Willow Creek cannabis farmer is getting a second chance as Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors has spared his permit from being revoked. Doing business as Ghost Ship Investments, LLC, Evacio Machado's cultivation permit was up for revocation at the October 28th supervisors meeting. The permit for 47,000 square feet of outdoor and mixed light cannabis was suspended last March due to $5,000 of unpaid planning department fees and several compliance issues. They include use of monofilament netting, failure to submit an energy plan, and not having enough water storage. The suspension bars cannabis cultivation until fixes are made, but an inspection last summer found the farm active. With lack of response to the compliance directives, staff recommended revocation of Machado's permit. But he asked for a break, explaining the condition of the site when he bought it in 2021 as the cannabis market headed for a downturn.
When I acquired it, they had a bunch of issues. It was pretty dirty and garbage all over the place, had issues with fish and game that I needed to do some covert work. I spent over $80,000 to get that taken care of. And, you know, slowly I've been improving. It has been a struggle. No need to explain too much, as you guys know about the industry. And I have been trying to basically survive.
Explaining the unpaid fees, Machado said he had to borrow money to cover the cost of state licensing and focused on that. He acknowledged non-response to county violation notices, saying he was overwhelmed. Planning Director John Ford said Machado was given ample opportunity to work with the county on the issues.
He was advised in 2024 that he cannot cultivate in 2025 until the permit is in compliance.
Right. So then,
when we ran into the situation where we saw that there's a pretty large balance, it was like, okay, we're going to suspend that because we've got no more avenues. We can educate, we can encourage, we can say stop, but when somebody runs through the stop sign and they run through the suspension, there's no more avenues.
Board Chair Michelle Bushnell said Machado's debts go beyond fees as he owes over $15,000 in property taxes and almost $19,000 in Measure S excise taxes. Asked about environmental issues, planning staff said, aside from some road erosion in spots, the site is, quote, fairly clean. Supervisor Rex Bone questioned whether revocation will ultimately be in the county's best interest, saying, quote, if we vote to uphold this, then we've got a snowball's chance in hell of collecting our back taxes. But Supervisor Steve Madrone warned against being too lenient.
We keep extending deadlines. We keep allowing for illegal cultivation when licenses have been suspended. There's a product sitting out there that occurred illegally that's going to get sold, you know? And so, I mean, if we are always going to be really soft on all of these things, then I would think that we as a board should not be surprised of the outcome of people not paying us, not paying their taxes, not paying their invoices for fees for staff time, not going ahead and growing regardless, because there's no repercussions. You know, I mean, that's the message out there. I keep hearing this over and over again when these things come before us that, well, it wasn't going to be so bad if I didn't deal with the county. It was going to be a lot worse if I didn't deal with the state and things like that. So, I mean, it's a real conundrum.
Bushnell motioned to preserve the permit with the condition that all fees be paid by the end of the year, which is also the deadline for paying Measure S tax debts, and for Machado to communicate with planning staff, quote, on what he's going to do to become compliant and get his permit back in good standing. There was some debate on it, but Ford said if Machado doesn't make good on his obligations, quote, we would still need to bring it back for a hearing, but we could turn it around fairly fast. The board voted 4-1 in favor of Bushnell's motion, with Madrone dissenting. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Ferndale Wildcats continue with their perfect season so far, and more. Here's Ray Hamill with the sports report.
The Ferndale Wildcats still have not allowed a single point through 8 of their 10 regular season games as they look to close out a perfect campaign on the football fields over the final 2 weeks of the regular season. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Wildcats and their pursuit of some history in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest high school football news from around Humboldt and Mendocino counties, how College of the Redwoods suddenly finds itself back in the chase for a conference title, news of an exciting week in NCS volleyball, why it was a particularly memorable week on the soccer fields for one local school, and how the HDNL golfers fared at this week's North Coast Section tournament. But first up, the Wildcats continued to roll on the football field this past weekend, cruising to a 67-0 win over Hoopa at Coach Carlson Wildcat Field. Incredibly, Ferndale has now outscored its first 8 opponents 517-0, including outscoring their conference opponents 291-0 in 4 Little 4 games. Just as impressive, 7 different players accounted for the team's 10 touchdowns against Hoopa, showcasing the remarkable depth the Cats possess at the skill positions. 3 of their 10 touchdowns came on special teams and 2 on defense as they opened up an insurmountable 60-0 lead before halftime. With the win, the Cats improved to 8-0 overall and 4-0 in conference play, while Hoopa dropped to 2-6 and 1-3. Also in the Little 4 last weekend, the Arcata Tigers kept their championship hopes alive with a 40-26 win over McKinleyville. The Tigers are now 4-4 overall and 3-1 in the Little 4, with a huge upcoming showdown against Ferndale in next week's regular season finale, while McKinleyville dropped to 2-6 and 0-4. The 4 Little 4 schools will be back in action this weekend, with Ferndale playing at McKinleyville and Hoopa at Arcata both on Friday night. The Big 4 championship, meanwhile, could be decided this weekend. Conference leader St. Bernard's improved to 4-0 in the Big 4 with a 28-0 win over Eureka on Saturday night. Like Ferndale, the Crusaders are also 8-0 in the season and 2 wins from an undefeated campaign. But they'll have their hands full on the road this Saturday night against the Fortuna team that remains in contention for the conference championship. The Huskies improved to 3-1 in the Big 4 and 4-4 overall, with a 28-14 win at Del Norte last week, a result that eliminated the Warriors from conference contention. If Fortuna wins this Saturday, the race for the championship will go down to the final weekend of the season, but if the Crusaders win, they will be crowned outright champions for the first time since they joined the Big 4 back in 2018. Del Norte is now 1-3 in conference and 4-4 overall, while Eureka, which has lost 7 straight games, is now 0-4 and 1-7. The South Fork Cubs, meanwhile, got back to winning ways at Calistoga last weekend, winning 50-28 1 week after losing at Tamales. The Cubs are now 3-1 in the NCL3 and 5-2 overall as they get set to play at California School for the Deaf on Friday. The season is also winding down for the Mendocino County schools, many of which remain in the chase for the upcoming NCS playoffs. The Wolverines hosted Cloverdale last week and cruised to a 47-0 win to go to 5-1 in the NCL1 and 7-1 on the season, while Fort Bragg had a bye and Ukiah travelled to Petaluma and handed St. Vincent de Paul its first loss of the year by a score of 27-6, improving to 3-0 in conference and 5-3 overall. This Friday night, Willets plays at unbeaten St. Helena, while Ukiah plays at Maria Carrillo, and Fort Bragg, which is 3-3 in conference and 3-5 overall, will host Cloverdale. In local college football, meanwhile, after two straight wins, College of the Redwoods is back in the race for a conference championship. Last Saturday, CR hosted Shasta and won 38-24. The victory lifted CR to 2-1 in the National NorCal Conference and into a three-way tie for second in the standings, along with Sierra and American River, all three of whom are just one win behind Butte, which is 3-0 in conference. And with upcoming games at Butte on Saturday afternoon and at home against American River next week, Redwoods suddenly finds itself with everything still to play for. Switching gears, it was a big week in local high school volleyball with five HDNL teams qualifying for the NCS playoffs. All five were in action on Wednesday night, with three league teams advancing to this weekend's quarterfinals. In Division 4 action, Eureka edged Del Norte in five sets as the Loggers secured a first playoff win in around two decades, according to head coach Stephanie Napoleon, while Arcata fell in five sets to Pinole Valley. In Division 6, Ferndale won in five sets at Cornerstone Christian, and St. Bernard's won in straight sets against Brave Christian. In local high school soccer, meanwhile, it was a good week for the Arcata Tigers. On Saturday, the Arcata girls defeated McKinleyville 2-0 and clinched the Big Four championship, while 4 days later, the Arcata boys tied 1-1 at Fortuna on the final day of league play to capture an HDNL title for the first time since 2022. In Little Four girls action on Tuesday, the Del Norte Warriors handed the Ferndale Wildcats their first loss since opening day and ended their 17-game unbeaten streak in Crescent City, winning 1-0. The Cats, however, had already clinched the conference title and remained the top-ranked team in the NCS in fall soccer. The NCS playoff fields will be announced this weekend, with the postseason set to start next week. And rounding out another busy week in local sports, the girls' golf season concluded for the HDNL teams at the NCS Division II tournament at Baywood Golf and Country Club in Arcata on Monday. League champion Bria Larson of Del Norte was the highest placed local girl with a round of 105. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
Turning to Mendocino, Flock cameras raise privacy concerns in Fort Bragg. Mendo Local News' Elise Cox reports.
In Fort Bragg, posters alerting residents to the presence of automated license plate readers have ignited privacy concerns. I'm Elise Cox, reporting for KMUD News and MendoLocal.News. It's been more than 2.5 years since the city of Fort Bragg agreed to install 7 automated license plate readers. These cameras, provided by a company named Flock Safety, are installed throughout the city. The cameras are controversial. Cities like Austin, Denver, Eugene, and Eureka have rejected the cameras or ended contracts after public backlash over privacy concerns. But in Fort Bragg, the cameras were approved quietly back in January 2023 without discussion as part of the consent calendar. The move wasn't covered by the local media at the time. Since then, police in Fort Bragg and Ukiah have credited Flock cameras with helping solve crimes ranging from auto theft to assault with a deadly weapon. Results that appear to validate the council's 2023 resolution, which stated that the cameras, quote, have demonstrated the ability to locate dangerous subjects, missing persons, and solve crimes. Until recently, the public accepted police justification for the cameras at face value. Then posters began appearing in Fort Bragg with the headline, quote, Flock AI cameras track our every move. Residents began asking questions. Anne-Marie Weibel raised the issue at a recent city council meeting.
I don't know how many of you are checking the MCN listserv, but lately many members in the community are quite upset about the 7 cameras that are in existence, if there aren't any more, I don't know, in Fort Bragg. Taking photos of cars coming and going south, north, and so on. Citizens are demanding for more transparency. And so, you know, this information is also accessed by the police.
Interim Chief Eric Swift responded that some of the claims made in the posters are simply not true.
I'll start by saying the flock cameras that we have are not surveillance cameras. The flock cameras we have are specifically tied to a crime, so it's tied to the vehicle itself or the description of the vehicles. So if there's a crime, then we have the hot sheets, what alerts us. The cameras are not just taking pictures or just videos of people.
Swift also said that Fort Bragg owns the data.
The other thing I'll say is the data is owned by Fort Bragg PD, and that data is secured. It's illegal for us to share that data with the federal government or other federal agencies or out of state. That data is also, after 30 days, it automatically deletes. So we don't have it after 30 days.
It is true that Fort Bragg's contract with Flock Safety says the footage belongs to the police department. But the agreement also allows Flock to access or disclose the footage to law enforcement authorities, government officials, and third parties if legally required to do so, or if Flock has a good faith belief that such access, use, preservation, or disclosure is reasonably necessary. A state law, Senate Bill 34, restricts how agencies can use license plate data. But an investigation earlier this year found that police and sheriff's departments in Los Angeles, San Diego, and Orange counties violated that law more than 100 times in a single month in 2025 by sharing data with federal agents, including ICE and Customs and Border Protection. Burns found that more than 200 law enforcement agencies had access to Humboldt County's data.
Eventually, once I got most of the records released to me, I could see that during that time, the sheriff's office had granted more than 200, nearly 300 California law enforcement agencies pretty much open access to their system. And during that time, these agencies conducted more than 700,000 searches of the data.
And many searches lacked a clear reason.
A law, Senate Bill 34, I believe it is, that prescribes the steps that law enforcement is supposed to take to gain access to this information. And it includes listing a reason for why you are, accessing it. And in practice, a lot of times law enforcement agencies are not listing a reason, or when they do, they're listing very general reasons. You know, they could just type in crime or justice or investigation, which doesn't give, say somebody were to come back and audit the access logs, it doesn't give them any useful information that can tie that to an actual investigation or crime.
Burns said the sheriff's office provided written responses to his questions, but the records suggest the department may be violating both its own policy and state law.
The responses answered some questions and raised some others. It still seems, based on those responses, it still seems like the sheriff's office is routinely violating its own policy as well as California law. So we'll see what happens after this. I suspect that the Board of Supervisors might want to revisit this issue.
For KMUN News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This weekend on the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Oregon, volunteers will search for 71-year-old Wesley Dixon Jones, a tribal elder who's been missing since October 5th. As Buffalo's Fire senior reporter Brian Bull explains, the search team is testing a device that the coordinator says could be a game changer.
Kimberly Lenning of MMIW Search and Hope Alliance out of Portland says Aqua Eye Pro bounces echoes off underwater objects, then compares them to the echoes of a human body.
It scans 1 acre of water up to 180 feet about every 30 minutes. And that is what we're going to take down on the deep pockets of the Umatilla on our search. If Mr. Jones is in the water, this will find him.
Jones's daughter, Molly Ann, is hopeful the device will deliver.
and then also utilizing canines and divers to help locate my father. Right now, this is very, very important, utilizing that resource.
Lennon says her group is using the Aqua Eye on a trial basis. She hopes perhaps donors will cover the $29,000 cost of one they can use permanently. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The government shutdown is delaying funding for a federal heating assistance program. In Alaska, thousands of low-income families use the program to offset their heating costs and to weatherize their homes for winter. Many of them are tribal citizens. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden has more.
The Alaska Department of Health said in a statement Thursday that the government shutdown has delayed the release of money for the federal low-income home energy assistance program for the year of 2026. The program subsidizes energy bills for about 50,000 Alaskans, many of whom live in rural and tribal communities. Jennifer Hyde is a federal infrastructure coordinator at the statewide nonprofit, the Alaska Center.
It definitely benefits a lot of rural and tribal communities. Disproportionately, those communities are often, you know, low income or have different economic struggles.
For now, the state health officials say they are operating the program using the remaining money from the previous year, and they say they expect that money to run out by mid-November. The department said it usually takes 4 to 6 weeks for the heating assistance funds to be released to states after the shutdown is over. Alaska tribal organizations are raising the alarm. The Tenant Chiefs Conference administers heating assistance for over 1,200 households. Amber Vasca is the executive director of Tribal Government and Client Services at the organization. She said by email that the federal program is, quote, a lifeline across the interior, end quote. Vasca said that the program, which also helps people weatherize their homes to cut on heating costs, is a way to ensure pipes don't freeze when temperatures drop to minus 50. The government shutdown is also affecting other programs crucial for Alaska Native communities, like food assistance and Tribal Head Start. Hyde, with the Alaska Center, says families who rely on heating assistance are the same vulnerable residents who will be affected by the loss of food benefits.
It's going to be a really tough winter unless something can give.
In the meantime, the State Department of Health said its staff is prioritizing applications by focusing on households in the heating emergency or at immediate risk of losing heat. I am Alona Naiden.
Tribes across the country are preparing for the halt of federal food benefits beginning November 1st due to the government shutdown. The Shawnee tribe in Oklahoma declared an emergency this week, releasing emergency funds to help citizens who may lose their benefits. Chief Ben Barnes said in a statement the federal government may be closed, but the Shawnee tribe's government remains open, and no Shawnee family should go hungry because of political dysfunction in Washington. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Ray Hamill, Elise Cox, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Matt Cardos.